This is one of my like top 10 or 15 favorite Kate Bush songs ever, even in its completely stripped down form. So I'm really happy to talk about it, especially because I actually didn't really pay that much attention to the lyrics before making notes for this episode. I just always have been really caught up in her vocal delivery and the music as opposed to the lyrics. But the lyrics are actually interesting too.
That they
So I'm
are.
excited. Yeah, so I'm excited. This is just such a wonderful. I love this song so much, and I wish more fans knew about it.
Welcome to Strange Phenomena, the music of Kate Bush. I am Cecily Link, and this week we're going to be talking about the first B-side for the B-side portion of the third season. This is this week's song, The Empty Bullring, which was a B-side to Breathing. So here we're going to be talking about The Empty Bullring. With me to talk about the song this week. Go on and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Zoe. I've been on a lot of other episodes, and this is one of my like top 10 or 15 favorite Kate Bush songs ever, even in its completely stripped down form. So I'm really happy to talk about it, especially because I actually didn't really pay that much attention to the lyrics before making notes for this episode. I just always have been really caught up in her vocal delivery and the music as opposed to the lyrics. But the lyrics are actually interesting too.
That
so
they are.
I'm excited. Yeah, so I'm excited. This is just such a wonderful. I love this song so much, and I wish more fans knew about it. It's one of those cases where you just go on YouTube and look up The Empty Bullring because you can't really find it anywhere else.
Nope.
But it's one of her, I think it's one of her best works. It's really musically sophisticated. So I love it.
Indeed. So I guess we'll get right into it here. So this was a B-side to the single Breathing, and that single was released on April 14th, 1980, because remember, Breathing was the lead single from Never Forever. So this was, notably for me, this is, I think, one of the first non-album tracks to be on the B-side of a single, because everything else up until then was a song from that album, but this is the first like, no, you have to get this particular R45 in order to get this song.
It's also a really interesting choice to pair with Breathing, because they're kind of opposite. So Breathing is all about the production, and this is really stripped down, so it's really showing you the two sides of her versatility. And to me, kind of having these paired together is kind of exemplifies why this period of her career is kind of my favorite. Her mastery of production and vocals that you see on one half on Breathing, and then her mastery of vocals and storytelling and musicianship on this other half with Empty Bullring. It's just like A+ both contents. It doesn't get better. But it is interesting to have with something as heavy as and production-y as Breathing to then have this basically like acoustic song.
Yeah, and also that it's short. It's less than 2.5 minutes. But it's got a story, it's got a characters, it's got a plot, it's got all of that, and in just less than 2.5 minutes. It's fascinating.
And like all the key changes in the world.
Oh, I know. I especially love the opening riff of this song. Like, it's like sets this tone for like something that's a little bit off kilter. Oh, it's just awesome. Oh my goodness.
everything about it. Yeah.
Indeed. And like you, I didn't really listen to the lyrics very much until I started digging in for this episode. I was just listening to her vocal delivery and the piano, since, you know, I love playing piano. I play piano, so I'm listening for the piano, and I like hearing like the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da kind of riff behind her. I have always liked this song. There was just, it's the off-kilter piano, it's her vocal delivery, like the way she drags out the first word of the song, disappear.
Yeah. And like every word thereafter, basically.
Disappear. Pretty much.
Just like I've talked before in other episodes about how much I love her technique of dragging out words until they're almost unintelligible. And she does that a lot here. So I just love it. And there's so many places where she'll just completely change an octave in the middle of a word. I just always was so absorbed in her vocal delivery and the musical sophistication behind that to really thing with the lyrics. Like, for example, on the word Toro, I didn't even know she was saying that because she goes to a completely different octave in the middle of the word. So sometimes because she does that, you don't really know. It's kind of like, I mean, you'll know this better than me, Cecily, because you're fluent in French. But when I was taking French classes, my teacher said, never listen to Edith Piaf to try to learn French. Because she puts like stress it on really random syllables, and so it's actually not that, it's not like how you speak French, it's not that intelligible. I feel that way kind of like about Kate Bush. Like, if someone, I would be like, don't learn how to speak English listening to Kate Bush, because they're gonna be stressing really random syllables all the time.
Yeah, that is true, especially with Edith Piaf, because in French, the last syllable of every polysyllabic word is what's emphasized. That's where stress always falls in French. And in English, it's so arbitrary as to where that stress falls. And you can generally tell somebody who's a native French speaker when they're trying to speak English. I can tell that they're native French because they are going to talk like this.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, okay, there's a little something off. And then if you realize that they're putting the stress on the other syllable, then... Like, yeah, that is true with Edith Piaf. I'm not terribly familiar with a ton of her stuff. I mean, I've seen the movie about her, but I can see like where your French teacher would say, don't listen to Edith Piaf to learn French.
Yeah, I remember like we played some of her songs and like had to read along the lyrics. And it's just like, you wouldn't even know she was saying those words, because like Kate Bush will say, like, for example, which is, oh, Lord. I didn't even know she was saying that.
Me neither.
It's the same as Edith Piaf. Like, she'll be saying a word that doesn't even sound like the French word.
She also...
Because she just completely uses... She's using her voice as an instrument, too.
My first thought was that, like, this was about somebody who's watching a loved one obsessing over something that they can't have. Her boyfriend was gored by a bull, and that's just warped his mind so much that he goes to this bull ring to try and fight the bull that isn't there. And she tries to reach him and tell him, no, you need to stop obsessing over this, but he's not listening because he's all, oh, well, I'm a man, I know everything. But then also, like, I was thinking about maybe it's a condemnation of toxic masculinity in a way, that she's trying to get she's trying to kind of get him away from the violent life, I suppose, and show him that,
hey, totally agree.
Like, no, you need to be here with me where everything is nice and calm up in my tower, if like literally or figuratively. So that was my first interpretation, was like literally somebody watching, somebody obsessing over something they can't have. But now I'm starting to think it's more against violence and war.
It's funny, because actually reading the lyrics, I was reminded so much of Army Dreamers, and kind of then got this broader view into what I'm going to call the small, refined genre of women dealing with men, male bravado, and having to watch them do shit and things that they probably shouldn't be doing and put up with it. So Army Dreamers is about a mother of a soldier, and, you know, he died before his 20s. What a waste. So he basically is compelled to go into war and lose his life and waste it, and she's only watching from afar. And in this song, it's also from the point of view of a woman watching her male lover participate in violence from afar so that he can basically boost up his own self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just something you don't really hear often in music. Army Dreamers is unique because it's about war from the perspective of a soldier's mother, but I think you can extend that and say she actually has quite a few songs that are about women watching men be stupid and telling them not to be stupid, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Army Dreamers, you have this, of course I'm going to bring it up, Night of the Swallow is about, our running gag is I've mentioned Night of the Swallow every mm-hmm. episode. I realized I didn't bring it up when we recorded for Warm and Soothing, and then I was like, oh, I didn't bring it up. But anyways, but Night of the Swallow is about a woman telling her lover who's a smuggler, not to go to Malta and not to fly mm-hmm. to Malta. That's just really fascinating. Like, there's not that many, like, I think it's just a big trope since the beginning of humankind that women have to put up with men doing BS for glory, mm-hmm. but it's always from the man's perspective. It's not often from the woman's perspective. And here's three songs of hers that are completely about that. And that's really fascinating. Like, I've spent the summer rereading the song, the series of Song of Ice and Fire, which is what mm-hmm. Game of Thrones is based on. And that series is so much, especially my favorite books in the series are book 2 and 4, but book 2 especially is kind of about the futility of war, and particularly the character of Catelyn Stark.
Mm-hmm.
In her point of view chapters, it's about kind of watching her son and other men make bad decisions and mm-hmm. being helpless to stop that because she's a woman and people don't listen to her. That's interesting because I think that's something that's been true from the beginning of time, but it's not really something you hear about in media or pop culture. It's usually about the war itself and not its impact on the women who are kind of on the sidelines. And so I think with that's part of why I really love Catelyn's point of view chapters. And I also really like about this song, Night of the Swallow, and Army Dreamers. And yes, it's kind of like mini genre of women being like, stop it.
Yeah. Dude, stop being dumb. Come on.
Yeah, because they're basically like, this guy is just like fighting in the empty bull ring. So like the ultimate song that is the woman having to deal with men and their bravado is, I hate to bring up Joanna Newsom in talking about Kate Bush, because I think oftentimes music critics compare them. It's really lazy. It's like, oh, they're both weird, so we're going to compare them.
Mm.
But he has a song, one of my favorite songs of hers is called Go Long. And it is a brutal, like, it's one of the most feminist songs ever. It's a brutal evisceration of masculine bravado. It's so good. It's just like, and she sings, to compare them, unfortunately, like with Kate Bush, how she'll still sing things that are actually really dark, but because she kind of gets away with it because she sounds pretty. With Joanna Newsom, she'll sing things that are really dark or really, like this song, it really is dragging the male figure, but you don't really realize it because her voice sounds so otherworldly. But Go Long is a song about being a woman watching men having to prove their worth. So some of the lyrics are, with the loneliness of you mighty men, with your jaws and fists and guitars and pens.
Hmm.
I've never been to the fire pits with you mighty men. And then kind of this crescendo goes, you burn in the Mekong, so like alluding to Vietnam War, to prove your worth. Go long, right over the edge of the earth. So it's kind of talking about these men,
mm-hmm.
they're just in their desire to prove themselves, will just fall off the face of the earth, like in Army Dreamers. And you keep palming along the wall, moving at a blind crawl, but always rambling.
Mm-hmm.
So all this, there's like this subgenre of songs that women who have to watch men go to extremes to prove their worth, but ultimately it's futile. And the women are just waiting for them or losing them.
And women are just like, guys, you don't have to prove anything. I already love you the way you are, or something like that.
Society would be very different if men didn't fit to prove it. I mean, why do we have? I mean, women would be in war, obviously, too. Women can be just as vicious as men. But
yep.
But yeah. I mean, I think this song, I just was thinking of Go Long so much. Maybe, I don't know if you can play a clip from it, of like the burn in the Mekong part.
Mm-hmm.
And she also, it's really clever. She has a line where she's like, with your guitar, like you mighty men with your pens and your guitars. Mm-hmm. And she specifically, as a woman who plays harp, and like Kate Bush was a woman who plays piano, these are very feminized instruments. It's this whole thing of like men who play guitar are so much more, are so superior. Men who write are like so cool. But a woman who sits by, who does something in a more feminine way, that's not considered adventurous enough. Whereas men have to go to the Mekong to prove their worth, or go to the empty bull ring,
yeah,
or fly to Malta.
Kate is talked just a little bit about this song in the Kate Bush Club newsletter from 1983. She says, "This is a song that I first had ideas for quite a few years ago. It's really about someone who's in love with someone who's obsessed with something that's pretty futile. They can't get the person to accept the fact that it is a futile obsession. To put it in a sort of story form, he became a matador and got gored so badly that he couldn't carry on. But at night he climbs out of the window and runs off to a bull ring where there's no one there, and he fights a bull that doesn't exist. Tamlin is a girl in a traditional fairy story who is locked up in an ivory tower." And we'll get to Tamlin when we start talking about the lyrics. But that's what Kate is saying.
I'm wondering how is he alive?
Hmm?
How is he alive? He got gored so badly, but he's just like alive and can run off. Okay.
I mean, maybe he probably got gored, but it was enough that he got to, he hung on by a thread and he's now alive-ish.
Or intestine.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what Kate said about this song. I'm more of like the bravado sort of thing, but yeah, that's just me. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of art. We get to have our own to read. I think they're both correct. I mean, what she's saying is what the song's about, but I think if you take it a step further, it becomes about this like analysis of bravado and having to look on, be passive, a passive onlooker. But I mean, she's someone who doesn't really analyze her own work in a feminist way, so she would, I don't think she would see it that way.
So let's see. So we're kind of touching a little bit on kind of our personal thoughts on the song, like me talking about how I've always liked this song. I like how short and concise it is, but it's got a complex story. I love her chord progressions. They continue to fascinate me. And you can really hear it here when it's just so bare bones. This feels like, because it's just a piano and vocal, like it's just a better recorded version of something she might have written when she was a teenager or something like that.
Yeah. Do you know when it was recorded?
No, I don't. I haven't been able to find anything about when this was recorded. I'm going to assume that it was maybe around the same time as Warm and Soothing, because her voice is similar on those tracks in a sense that both songs have like huge leaps in melody, and they're both very short and complex and concise.
You know, I was curious because, as you said, it sounds like she said, "I had the idea for this a few years ago," and it does sound a lot like one of her demos, just with better quality.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if this is another one where, like with Warm and Soothing, you said, "Oh, we're going to test out Abbey Road and see how this works."
Yeah.
But I'm glad she didn't just throw it away. I'm glad she used it as a B-side.
Seriously.
Because, and I wonder, I always think about, I love it so much as it is, what would it have been like if it were fully produced, you know? Especially since Never Forever is an album that's so much about the production and exotic instruments. Maybe I wouldn't like it as much. I don't know. We'll never know.
I think that if this had been more fleshed out, it would have been too busy. Because on its own, it's got a cool moving piano part. She's not just playing block chords, like she's playing little melodies and riffs behind her. And I think having drums and bass and anything else behind her would just be too much.
Well, I wonder if it would have been something more like the Infant Kiss, where it is mainly piano based, but there's other elements there. But yeah, it's a double-edged sword of wanting to know what it would have been like, but also loving the original so much that maybe it wouldn't have been as good anyway.
Yep.
I think it's pretty much perfect in its current form.
And really, there aren't very many bare bones songs like this that she has officially released either. I mean, there's this one.
Right.
There's Warm and Soothing. And then in the Hounds of Love season, I'll get to talk about Under the Ivy, which is just, which does have a background vocal in it for the, for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, even that has the whoo, whoo thing.
Yeah. But it, but otherwise, it's just voice and piano. And yeah, there just aren't very many just Kate and the piano songs. And this is really the first
of those. Under the Ivy feels more produced in general somehow. It seems, it feels more like, okay, money was put into this than the Empty Ballroom does.
Well, it was recorded in an afternoon at her new recording studio, so.
Yeah. No, I saw you point out you love, like, the opening of the song. It's the way she stresses out the word disappear. It's so great. It's just a classic Kate-ism, you know? It's love that, too. I just, it's one of those, she, I love when she opens a song in a way, like with Wuthering Heights or like with Hammer Horror, on this really startling note, and you're just like, oh, what was that?
Yeah, I mean, it goes, it starts in, it's, I'm actually looking at the sheet music for it, from Kate Bush Complete. It's technically in the key of C because there's no flats or sharps, but then, but it's, the riff starts in E major, which has nothing to do with C major at all. Then it goes to C, then G, then F and C, B flat and A for the trying to keep him at home. And I noticed on that, like me being you music nerd, that when she gets to that line, it sounds a little bit off when it gets to at home. And that's because you got an A major next to B flat. And you don't usually, you don't have A flat, you don't have the A chord in B flat major. They just have completely different...
I love, like, you listening to this song, you kind of never know what note she's going to hit next. So I love the unexpectedness.
I mean, there's no, like, repeating the same four chords in this song, for sure.
No, no, not at all. She has this thing that I call her weepy voice. Mm-hmm. The song, probably her whole body of work, which is the most, I'd say, is All the Love on the Dreaming. But she has this thing where she kind of sounds like she's crying while she's singing. But I love, like, she does it on the line you pointed out. So again, regain something. It sounds like you can almost see her pouting as she sings it.
To regain something.
And then also on where else does she do it? I have it written down. But yeah, like on the last draw, on the last draw, oh Lord. Well, I also didn't even know she was saying last draw, oh Lord.
I'm sorry, me neither.
She was stressing out the word straw. But she does this thing where she is like emoting while singing, and it sounds like she's crying, like she's in the tower watching the dude be stupid and crying over it. So that's just her yet again really imbuing every element of her performance with deep emotion. Which is what she does so well and will continue to do, like I said, and really push herself, for example, on The Dreaming with Houdini, where she literally drank like a quart of milk in order to get her voice congested enough to get the emotion she wanted. She's always about capturing the emotion behind the words, not just singing the words. Having this and Breathing paired together, like, show how these are kind of her best, just to me, why this is my favorite vocal moment of her career, because Breathing, she's doing very different things vocally. Like, this is, again, even though she's doing really wacky things with her voice on this song, it is very, and this gets said about her a lot, so it's annoying, it's kind of male music critic thing to say, but she does sound very angelic. Like, I feel like I'm kind of listening to a little angel choir or something, but like a wacky angel choir. And then on Breathing, she's really pushing through and getting really raw, so it just shows her versatility. That you thought you can have, like, have one disc that has these two songs on it that are doing completely different things vocally, but are still both astounding vocally.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is honestly my favorite era vocally for her as well, because she's starting to do some new things with her voice, but it still sounds really pure and angelic, and I like that in her voice. I never, except for some of the parts of Don't Push Your Foot on the Heartbreak, I never think that she's ever screeching. I don't ever think that. I like the high notes, and I like that she explores more of her voice up there on this song, and honestly, most of the songs of this period, like a lot of female singers don't push themselves to go high or anything. Like it has to be.
Or men.
Or yeah. Oh yeah. That too. For men.
Definitely not men.
No, they definitely not. And like a lot of singers don't push themselves vocally in any way because, oh, we need to make sure that like little Susie Q can sing along with us on the radio.
So who is Tamlin?
Oh, yes. So Tamlin, very interesting. Tamlin, first of all, in the Kate Bush Complete, it says on that line, I'm looking at the sheet music, it says, out into Rome in the early hours, leaving me here like 10 men in her tower. I'm like,
oh, really?
It says 10 men. I'm like,
that's
no.
weird. Because, I mean, she's clearly saying, well, I mean, to be honest, I didn't know what she was saying for a while. She said something. But it's clear she's saying a name, Tamlane, which online it's spelled T-A-M-L-A-I-N-E.
Mm-hmm.
But for the longest time, and she said that she found the name, it was like from a fairy tale or a folk song. So I just assumed it was like an ye old Irish folk tale woman character who was stuck in a tower, like who was stuck. Character was stuck in a tower, but you found out some interesting intel.
Yeah, so Tamlin, which has many different spellings because old folk song always has that, is a character in a legendary ballad originating from the Scottish borders. It is also associated with a reel of the same name, also known as the Glasgow Reel. The story revolves around the rescue of Tamlin by his true love from the Queen of the Fairies. The motif of capturing a person by holding him through all forms of transformation is found throughout Europe in folk tales. Tamlin is a dude! Not a girl.
I have a dude, according to Wikipedia, who like takes woman's virginity or something. What was that?
Most variants.
Some weird thing.
Most.
Let me look it up again.
Most variants begin with the warning that Tamlin collects either a possession or the virginity of any maiden who passes through the forest of Carterhall. And I'll probably have to go read.
Yeah, Tamlin's a dog.
When a young woman, usually called Janet or Margaret, goes and plucks a double rose, Tam appears and asks her why she has come without his leave and taken what is his. She states that she owns the place because her father has given it to her. In most variants, Janet then goes home and discovers that she's pregnant. Some variants pick up the story at this point. When asked about her condition, she declares that her baby's father is an elf whom she will not forsake. In some versions, she is informed of an herb that will induce abortion. In all the variants, when she returns and picks a plant, either the same roses as on her earlier visit or the herb, Tam reappears and challenges her action. She asks him whether he was ever human, either after that reappearance or in some versions immediately after their first meeting resulted in her pregnancy. He reveals that he was a mortal man who, falling from his horse, was caught and captured by the Queen of the Fairies. Every 7 years, the fairies give one of their people as a tithe to hell, and Tam fears he will become the tithe of that night, which is Halloween. He is to ride as part of a company of elven knights. Janet will recognize him by the white horse upon which he rides and by other signs. He instructs her to rescue him by pulling him down from the white horse, so Janet catches him this time and holding him tightly.
Female emotional labor.
Yep. He warns her that the fairies will attempt to make her drop him by turning him into all manners of beasts, but that he will do her no harm. When he is finally turned into a burning coal, she is to throw him into a well, whereupon he will reappear as a naked man and she must hide him. Janet does as she is asked and wins her knight. The Queen of the Fairies is angry but acknowledges defeat. And in different variations, Tamlin is reported as the grandson of the Laird of Roxburgh and all sorts of other places. His name also varies between versions as Tom Lynn, Young Tambling, Tamaline, or Tamlane.
But long story short, Kate was pulling shit out of her ass. What were you going to say?
Oh, just that I think that what might have happened, and we were talking about this before we recorded, that probably she remembered the name, thought of like a fairy tale princess Rapunzel kind of lady, and put someone in a tower.
Right. Yeah. I agree. I think she probably like grew up with these stories, heard them, and then just like got confused and thought, I guess Tamlin's the one in the tower, but Tamlin is not the one in the tower. It's not even a woman, but it sounds nice. So I'm okay with it.
It is a good story. Like, I hadn't heard about this until 10 minutes before we started recording.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be a good Kate Bush song, honestly.
It really could, yeah.
Really? That's what, when you were saying it, I was just like, this would be really good material for one of her songs. But it's not. But just interesting that, yeah, it sounds like the kind of thing, like, you know, I'll think about, you know, we all have those moments where we're talking about some, like, a story that we learned as a kid, and then someone else, like, wait, no, that wasn't that person, you know? So you just mix up names and stuff. I think this was one of those scenarios. But it doesn't really hurt the song, I don't think.
I don't think so. Because
you can still paint a very, very vivid picture of a woman waiting in a tower, even if the woman is actually a virginity-stealing man.
Yeah. And, I mean, like you were saying, as I was kind of reading the synopsis of the story, that as we were talking about the song, like women having to bear the emotional burden of watching watching the guys just like make fools of themselves. That's how the ballad of Tamlin seems to go too. That that Janet or Margaret, depending on whatever version you read, that she's supposed to go in there and catch him and help him and get him away from where he's going to be transformed into things by the fairies.
This is an interesting reversal of the damsel in distress trope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too bad she didn't write a song about that. That would be a good song.
That would be a really cool song.
If you're listening.
Or maybe, I mean, who knows how many other songs Kate has written that haven't been released?
Yeah, maybe she wrote one about Tamlin but called it Janet or something.
Could be.
Got the name wrong. Yeah, but I would be interested in hearing that. Good stuff. All that folktale stuff is good stuff. But indeed. Yeah, clearly, I mean, she grew up on this because of the song Picking Inside and that being based in folktale. But it's interesting that she specifically said, oh, yeah, I got the name from this fairy tale story, but it's actually not.
Yeah. More like
you do you, Kate.
More like a ballad, but, well, she grew up on those kind of stories, so doesn't surprise me that it would be kind of sticking her head.
Right, you hear enough stories growing up that they all kind of get mixed. Like, I'm thinking of my grandma used to tell me so many stories growing up, and I kind of confuse them all. They all get a little mixed up in my head.
Well, I think we've pretty much covered everything on this song. I mean, it's like
less than
2.5 minutes.
Great. You also listen to it.
Since this is the first B-side episode where it was officially released, but it is not on Spotify or iTunes or any other place other than YouTube, I'm going to be doing a thing where I actually play the whole thing in full so that you all can hear what this sounds like.
Yes, and you'll be up for a treat because this song is just really... Just as I said a million times, just so complex musically. Mm-hmm. Like I know a lot of people I know who are musicians always say like, yeah, I can't cover Kate Bush songs because she's like the way she composes things is so unique and singular and specific to what she's able to do with her voice that most people can't do with their voices. Like I don't think most people could do that in the meaning, you know, and the whole choro. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't even know what she was saying. I was like, that's what she's saying. Okay.
Yeah, you just get lost in her pronunciation and her voice. Just like, oh, hey, we like your voice. Hey.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, I'm glad that we did get the chance to talk more about the lyrics because they do bring up a lot of interesting themes, especially considering, that's why I was curious to know when she wrote this. I'm like, I wonder if she wrote this before Army Dreamers because they do share some thematic elements.
I never thought about that before. Yeah, definitely. I do agree that this is very much like Army Dreamers.
And Night of the Swallow.
Mm-hmm.
But that was written later, although it was one of the first two recorded for The Dreaming.
Which I wouldn't be surprised if she was already starting to work on ideas for as soon as this album was released.
Yeah, and especially because that and Sad and You Laugh were recorded in 1981. And what's interesting is that she goes a step further in Night in the Swallow of making it actually a dialogue between two characters instead of just from the woman's point of view. But it is really cool, I think, from a feminist perspective, to have any form of art, whether that's as of the Catlin chapters in the song License Fire or this song or Go Long by Joanna Newsom, that's about what it means to be in the role of this woman as spectator, because it's just not something that gets light shed upon it at all, really.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah, I like the lines where she's saying, it's all you live for, but you've lost it all. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
It's like, that just reminds me so much of Army Dreamers. Like, he literally loses his life. What a waste.
And Glory and Gore, The Throw of the Rose, it's all you lived for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're doing it for people to go, yeah, man, you're awesome, yeah!
Yeah, for heroism.
Mm-hmm.
Without considering the consequence. Glad more people will know about this song now, because that's a good one.
Seriously. Wonderful, wonderful little song that I'm glad she ended up releasing, even though it's very different from the A-side. And everything else.
I wonder how many others like this and Mormon Soothing she had. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if there were even more. I mean, anything else she wrote like this was probably like hidden somewhere with the Never Forever title track.
Mm.
And Before the Dawn.
And Before the Dawn DVD. They're all in his death. burn upon my death.
Yeah. She's like, yeah, I'm putting it in I put it all in this locked, like, behind a really thick safe kind of closet.
Birdie, we are counting on you to be like the friend of Emily Dickinson, who did not burn herself upon her command. Birdie, come on.
Seriously.
Don't do it. I also need to know where certain outfits and certain music videos were. I need to know.
Me too, so I can try and like make patterns of them. That would be awesome. Make sewing patterns.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show this week talking about the Empty
Ring.
Yay.
You know, I'm happy to bring this song to more people's attention, because it's one of my favorites and such a gem, and really shows her talent as a musician in a very complex, seemingly simple but actually really complex way.
Indeed. And now, for everybody's listening pleasure, here is the whole of the Empty Bullring right here on this podcast, because you can't find it anywhere to purchase. Obviously, we would like everybody to make sure you buy Kate's albums or listen to them on Spotify, do whatever you can to support the artist. But in cases of these, like this song hasn't been re-released in any capacity. So here it is, the Empty Bullring, all in full. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And next week, we're going to get into another B-side. We're going to get into Rantan Waltz. So here's the Empty Bullring.
You kept the meaning, you feel in charge. You-
if you know something about this week's song that we didn't get to in our discussion, or if you have a favorite Kate Bush song or several songs that you want to talk about for a future episode, here's where you can find me. You can either email me, kbcast@linkmedia.com. That's link with an E. You can contact me through my website, kbcast.linkmedia.com. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/KateBushPodcast, and on Twitter @StrangeKateCast. Join us for another B-side next week. Next week, I will be talking with Keith Bloomfield DeWeese from Boston all about one of his favorite Kate Bush songs, Rantan Waltz. See everybody then.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.